Next case is number 093940, assessment against Jenkins, and as indicated earlier, each side will have up to 15 minutes to present its arguments today. Mr. Geis? Good morning.
I didn't hear the earlier announcement. We've increased it from 10 to 15 minutes. May it please the court. I represent Mr. Sussman and have represented him in post-conviction proceedings. Throughout, as you know, he was convicted in the state court of Wisconsin of a sexual assault of a minor, and also possession of child pornography. We have never challenged the child pornography conviction, but we have vigorously challenged the sexual assault conviction based on the ineffective assistance of counsel Strickland claim. And that's what the appeal from the denial of the habeas is here today, is the propriety of the district court's denial of our Strickland claim. And in the time I have, besides answering any questions that you will have for me, I would like to highlight just what it was that was left out of this case and how important it was to the defense because of defense counsel's admitted forgetting or omitting to file the necessary pretrial motion to get in the prior false accusation. And then I would like to explain why I believe that the district court's order is unsound and should be reversed. What the jury didn't know was that Scott, who is the complainant in this case, in 1998 had made a false accusation of sexual assault against his father under somewhat similar circumstances as existed in this case, and that was the male parental figure and mentoring, which was Mr. Sussman's relationship to Scott.
The earlier allegation had to do with events when the boy was 5 years old?
No. I believe that the allegation that he made against the father, he was indefinite. It's how many years ago it was, but I think that it was, he said that when he was 6 or 7 or 9 years old.
Didn't the state courts say that it had been 10 years earlier and about when he was about five? I'm misremembering that.
Well, 10 years earlier would have been this whole incident when Mr. Sussman supposedly happened in fourth grade when he was 9 or 10 years old.
Well, that didn't go in because he didn't comply with the rape shield law and make a preliminary motion, right?
That's right.
And that was decided against him on state grounds, exclusively, as far as I can see.
Well,
so I don't know why we have any prerogative to consider it.
Well, because it really, as I raised the issue in the state courts, and this is an important part of this appeal that you're bringing up here, was that that decision that this was not admissible under Wisconsin law was so unreasonable based on the facts that were before the Wisconsin court that we really had an ADEPA claim. And that was the way I brought this case on habeas.
That's a matter for the Wisconsin court.
I believe that the law is that when the state court evidentiary issue totally dovetails with the denial of a constitutional right that the federal courts do have the authority to review it. And I cite you to the Redmond case, which was the exact same statute in Wisconsin, the rape shield, and this court decided that case in a confrontation clause context, which is what it would have been here, except for the fact that it was had to be brought up in post-conviction as ineffective assistance of counsel. Now, more complicated in this case, as far as why is it in the federal court is concerned, is that the district court totally ignored the Wisconsin evidentiary ruling. And the district court denied our habeas because that court found that, assuming that the prior false accusation had been admitted, it didn't meet the Strickland prejudice prong. So the district court's analysis is totally a Strickland analysis, a Strickland issue. I never had the opportunity to argue in the district court that the state court decision was so unreasonable, saying that he hadn't claimed there was a sexual assault. Scott testified at the trial that he had accused his father of sexual assault. But that was the end of it, because when defense counsel then tried to get in his theory of the case that this was false and under certain circumstances, and that he had admitted to his mother and to his guardian, who was his aunt at that point, that he had did it because he had felt abandoned by his father and he was angry at his father, none of that ever could get in. So the jury never knew that there had been a similar false accusation under relatively similar circumstances. And don't forget in this trial that the jury heard that when the authorities began to investigate this case, and the detectives went out to Mr. Sussman and told him that these charges had been made against him, and they asked, detective asked Mr. Sussman, well, Mr. Sussman, why do you think that he would make a false accusation against you? And Mr. Sussman told the detective, and that was in evidence, that he thinks that it probably was vengeance because he had began to wind down this mentor relationship, and that Mr. Sussman had also heard from the father that he had done, Scott had done a similar thing to the father years ago. Not that many years ago, because he was only 9, 10 years old at the time. So the jury knew that. But what the jury never knew was this incredibly important information, that the accusation he had made against the father was false and under similar circumstances. And that's some pretty important information in a case that where the state's case on the sexual assault wasn't so overwhelming. And don't forget, the jury in this case also came back with not guilty verdicts on exhibiting this material to Scott. And Scott's testimony was full of the fact that every time that the sexual contact or masturbation occurred, that almost every time that Mr. Sussman had showed him child pornography as a prelude to this. He was found not guilty of that. And in the record, the trial judge, the state court trial judge, in his post-conviction opinion, says that it had been established that Scott was a liar, not just in general, but that he had lied about the details of these incidents that he claimed that going on with Mr. Sussman. So this was a fairly close case where we had some really important information that wasn't available to the jury, and there's no question that the reason it wasn't was because the attorney, who's a very experienced attorney, just forgot that he had to do a pretrial motion. And that was the sole basis for the trial judge's denying this. It was a sanction until I brought it as a ineffective assistance counsel claim in a post-conviction motion. And then he said, well, I would have denied it anyway. That's how we lost in the state court and came up with this, well, it wasn't really a sexual assault. Well, it was a sexual assault from the offer of proof. We know that the authorities from the psychiatric hospital in the court pursued and investigated and found out it was unsubstantiated. We know it was a sexual assault that this Scott repeated to his therapist over a period of 2 years, even after the authorities had determined it was unsubstantiated.
How do we reach that issue, though? Mm-hmm. To go back to Judge Cudahy's question.
We reach this issue based on the district court's decision, which assumed that the prior sexual accusation was admitted and before the court. Because the district court opinion is entirely based on the fact that we're not going to look at this.
Well, we review this decision de novo, right?
You review this decision?
We review the district court's decision de novo.
Yes.
And so, and we're confronted with a record in which both the state trial court and the appellate court said counsel's failure to file the motion before trial had no effect because this evidence would not have been admissible in any event as a matter of state evidence law.
So the way this comes down is, if you can't review the district court opinion because of the state court, then I never get to challenge the state court opinion.
Well, you've got to do that here, but you've told us we can't decide it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the district judge didn't decide it.
So what? Mm-hmm. I mean, well, Judge Crabb decided. Well, we know that the magistrate in his report and recommendation did address it. Judge Crabb did not reach that issue, but you still need to address it, right?
Well, I'd be glad to address it because I think that it's clear that that was a, you know, we'd go back to the ADPA then if we want to look at the state court decision and say the fact that it wasn't admissible under Wisconsin law, you know, was that a reasonable application of the facts? What the state court said, well, it wasn't really a sexual assault. What was it? He testified it was a sexual assault, and he testified he did it for a motive. So regardless of what the physical contact was, he alleged that he's being Scott is a sexual assault. And then what else did the state court said? Well, and also the prejudicial value was greater than the probative value. There is no prejudicial value. It's, the Redmond case is right on point. First of all, it's a lie. So there wasn't any reason for Scott to be embarrassed. And the prejudicial value is enormous and didn't get in. So I did have a problem in writing this brief. You know, was I addressing the state court opinion or was I addressing the district court opinion? And they're totally different. The district court never addresses, nor do I think it's the magistrate, about the evidentiary, state court evidentiary hearing. The district court says, basically, you didn't satisfy the Strickland prejudice test because...
I think you want to hear something about the note from the psychiatrist, too.
Well, the note from the psychiatrist, the denial was another thing. It's not nearly as prejudicial as the prior false accusation.
It could be very prejudicial.
Well,
don't ignore it completely.
I want to hear about it.
For one thing, they tell us, well, this wasn't admitted because the lawyer misunderstood the judge's ruling.
He did.
But nobody ever tells us what the ruling was or what he ignored or,
well,
or why this thing wasn't.
The ruling was that he couldn't ask this therapist about the prior false accusation. And the defense counsel understood that as being a universal ruling that he couldn't, Bryce Mitchell was the therapist's name, that he couldn't have Bryce Mitchell testify about anything. And so that was why he never called Bryce Mitchell and he never got in the 1998 denial. You know, Scott had denied this before he disclosed and then he denied it after he disclosed. But use the short time I have left for the district court opinion. The district court said, well, you didn't satisfy the Strickland prejudice because it's cumulative. He was allowed to ask Scott's mother about the matter. No, absolutely not. He never was allowed to bring in anything about the false accusation. He was allowed to ask Scott's mother after the sanction.
Well, there was evidence that they took judicial notice of the fact that in under Wisconsin law, somebody like the therapist had to report it if he indicated the existence of a crime.
If he would have admitted it to him.
And
right.
he hadn't reported it.
Right.
Therefore, he was reaching the same conclusion as he did when he sent the note. But to me, I think the note is a lot more effective evidence than some roundabout
I'm glad you do, because that was definitely in there. He had denied it. And this is before the disclosure and after. But finally, if I can, as far as the...
Your time's run out, even the extended time. Why don't you take 2 minutes for rebuttal? Mm-hmm. Okay. Mr. O'Brien.
May it please the court. I would first like to address the question on the note of the 1999 session. It is true that counsel misunderstood a pretrial ruling and failed to put in that evidence when he could have. However, counsel did put in evidence through other witnesses that Scott never complained to them, family members, friends, school staff members, about any sexual activity, and they did not, school people especially, did not observe anything unusual about his behavior.
Had he talked to any of those folks about other complaints of sexual contacts? As we know, he did talk to his therapist about it, right?
He talked to that's the 99 note, is to the therapist, Bryce Mitchell. Counsel did, and I think another important point to make is that the state never argued that Scott told anyone about this before he told his mother in 2002. And the allegations go back to 1998. So there is a time, it really was never disputed before the jury that Scott didn't complain until 2002. And in fact, counsel did that very cleverly in his closing argument to the jury, tie in his failure to report to anyone else, his many, I think, 65 counseling sessions with Bryce Mitchell during the time he was seeing Mr. Sussman, and the Indiana mandatory reporting law, to draw the inference and make the precise argument that he...
But this is a note from the therapist saying, this kid denied that this ever happened. I mean, it's a pretty effective piece of evidence.
Well, except the state put in strong evidence saying why children deny sexual assault at first, that they delay, through Dr. Salter explaining that even if had that note come in, Dr. Salter would have explained, yes, this is common behavior, that child sexual assault victims often deny to protect their accusers.
There seems to be all kinds of evidence all over the place that this kid was not very credible about much of anything. But
well, I think that's an overstatement.
It seems to me this evidence is a little more direct than some of this other.
Yeah, but I think, when I'm defending the performance of a defense attorney, I'm always put in the awkward position of arguing that, oh, this attorney did such a great job, and you almost wonder how the jury could have arrived at the verdict it did.
That was my question after reading your brief.
I would like to refer the court specifically not only to Scott's testimony, where he insists that he was assaulted many, many times over these years and explains in great detail what happened, but the corroborative testimony of Madison detectives Murphy and I'm drawing a blank on the other detective, Fry, where Fry interviewed both Scott and Mr. Sussman about the many times, the many contacts that he and Scott had over the years, and how they're, and about the times that they viewed pornography together on the computers. Detective Murphy's, the computer expert, who, after they seized Mr. Sussman's both home and work computer, talked about all the child pornography that was found on those computers the deleted sites the day before and the day of the search warrant, and the fact that some of this, much of this information corroborated Scott's testimony about what he said he viewed, and plus the many witnesses who talked about seeing red flags over the years in this relationship between Scott and Mr. Sussman. So
the jury acquitted him on the viewing charges, though, right?
They did. They acquitted him on the exhibition of harmful materials charge, and we can only speculate why that would be. The important point is they convicted him of the sexual assault and of the possession of the pornography. There was some evidence that Scott had on his own viewed pornography on Mr. Sussman's work computer. There were a couple of coworkers who testified that they caught him viewing this on his work computer. So, you know, it's conceivable that the jury gave him the benefit of the doubt on the knowing exhibition as opposed to providing access. But that's only speculation on my part. But I think, you know, and then we get to the false accusation. We are really talking about state evidence law here. Judge Martin, the trial judge, when he ruled pre-trial, or not pre-trial, but early, in the midst of trial, when defense counsel tried to raise this issue, Judge Martin said, he made two rulings. He said, based on the state's objection, which was the counsel didn't comply with the statutory requirement that he file a pre-trial motion, Judge Martin agreed. But Judge Martin also said, I think this stuff's pretty remote also, and I'm not sure that there's even a false accusation here. However, I will sustain the objection based on he failed to file a pretrial motion. When the issue came up again post-conviction, Judge Martin this time emphasized, after engaging in the analysis required under Wisconsin Statute 97211 and the Wisconsin Supreme Court's interpretation of that statute in State v. DeSantis, that this was indeed not admissible because he failed to satisfy the first and third DeSantis factors, the first one being it's not clear that this was a false accusation. Scott testified at trial. In response to cross-examination by Attorney Hurley, Scott testified that yes, I accused my father of sexual assault. And then he explained what that was. And he said, my father bathed me in the shower when I was 5 or 6 and touched my genitals. Now, the issue is that sexual assault, or is that a father properly bathing his child? He told Bryce Mitchell in the March 2000 therapy session about his father touching him between the legs. There's no specific allegation of sexual assault. In that session, the cryptic note that appears in the post-conviction motion, which I believe is in the appendix to Sussman's brief at page 47, that the cryptic note is something the effect of, it appears to express more confusion on Scott's part as to what that meant, if it meant anything at all. So there was a threshold issue about whether this was truthful, and while Attorney Hurley did have statements in his offer of proof from witnesses saying that they believed this was false, the state stood ready to prove that it was true, that this actually occurred. And Attorney Hurley testified at the post-conviction hearing that he talked to the father, and the father said, yes, the incident in the shower did occur when Scott was 5 or 6, but obviously denying that he intended any sexual gratification. So what you have here then is you get into the third part of the DeSantis test, which is the probative value of this, does this outweigh the potential to prejudice the jury, mislead the jury, or confuse the issues, which is the Wisconsin Statute 90403 is the statute relating to that.
All of exclusion were state grounds. Then.
That's correct.
Most relevant here, I think.
That is correct. That it is a state law.
You say the judge amplified the grounds on post-conviction. If he'd amplified them and talked about, you know, prejudice as a federal matter or something, then we'd have an issue as to whether this is a state ground or a federal ground.
Well, for example, had Mr. Sussman raised a separate challenge to the post-conviction evidentiary ruling by Judge Martin on the ground that not only was Attorney Hurley ineffective for failing to present this, but if the judge's evidentiary ruling is allowed to stand, then it denies me my right to confront my accuser or to present a defense. That argument was not made in the Court of Appeals. It was a straight challenge based on DeSantis and 972.11 in the Court of Appeals, as did the trial judge. Well, the Court of Appeals affirmed the trial judge, which on appeal in the state courts is a review for an erroneous exercise of discretion. And the Court of Appeals, in quoting at length Judge Martin's post-conviction ruling, it essentially held that he properly exercised discretion under state evidence law. So that is a matter absent a direct constitutional challenge, and furthermore, there's no confrontation clause challenge here, nor could there be because it wasn't raised in state court.
Mr. O'Brien, what was the downside of admitting this evidence?
Of the father's
holding of the genitals in the shower.
What was
the downside?
That evidence got in. The only evidence that didn't get in was the defense claim that it was a false accusation against the father. Scott clearly testified on cross that he did accuse his father of sexual assault, and he did explain that it would involve bathing in the shower. And he even went on to say that he told Bryce Mitchell, his therapist, about it. At that point, the state objected, and then the court sustained the objection to testimony about what he told Bryce Mitchell. So the issue is whether there's a downside to not putting in that this was a false accusation. And again, I think that ties into the judge's evidentiary ruling, that the state was prepared to dispute that this was false, and that could have resulted in a mini-trial on a collateral issue as to whether this was a false and exactly what it was the nature of the contact and that sort of thing. On the other hand, I'm not sure...
Well, he admitted it was false, didn't he?
He did not at trial, and and if you look at the notes from the therapy sessions with Bryce Mitchell, it doesn't appear he admits that it's false. At best, he admits to some confusion as to the significance of what his father did when he was 6 years old in the shower.
Didn't he admit that he did it out of anger and vengeance? Wasn't that the point?
That's what other people extrapolated from what he did. And there was plenty of evidence in trial that he had a bad relationship with his father, that there was anger at the father, just as Mr. Sussman testified in his own defense that, or Mr. Sussman didn't testify, but in his statement to police, Mr. Sussman said Scott was vengeful with him because he wasn't paying attention to him. But when we're reviewing Attorney Hurley's performance, and it's clear that he made at least one, maybe two mistakes here, but we review it as a whole. And I can't help but use the cliche, there are many ways to skin a cat. And Attorney Hurley skinned this cat, even though, despite his errors in a very complex and lengthy trial, to basically get before the jury the fact that Scott didn't report this to anyone before 2002 and, in fact, denied it to his mother's friend in 2004, 2 years after it occurred, and that he had accused his father of assault, and then counsel also put in evidence that he had admitted that he falsely accused Sussman of assaulting three other boys he was mentoring. So you tie all this together, and it's pretty clear to the jury, okay, Scott didn't report this until 2002. He denied it to someone, at least after the fact. Had he reported it, all of these people would have had to report, at least school and therapy people. And Scott, we the jury know that Scott did accuse his father of assault, sexually assault. He also falsely accused Sussman of assaulting other boys. We can tie this all together and say, well, you know, his allegation against his father was probably false because the state doesn't try to prove, and the state didn't try to prove that it was true, since it didn't have to, just because of the trial court's evidentiary ruling. And so these matters were effectively put before the jury, and you look at counsel's closing argument, where he hammered on the point that Scott denied, based on all these efforts, that Scott must have denied to Bryce Mitchell that he was assaulted by Sussman, and that Scott had all kinds of motives to falsely accuse Mr. Sussman, just as you could infer that he falsely accused his father. But again, at least with the issue regarding the father, we're talking about a state evidence ruling that was not challenged on a constitutional basis in the state courts and is subject to deference. And because that evidence wouldn't have come in the eyes of the trial judge, and because that trial judge's ruling not that it wouldn't have come in was upheld on review of discretion by the Court of Appeals, then counsel is not ineffective for failing to put in evidence that wouldn't have come in. And so we satisfy Strickland, whether you call that a deficient, satisfying the deficient performance prong or the no prejudice prong, because since the evidence wouldn't have come in, there's no reasonable probability of a different outcome. So again, Attorney Hurley did a very effective job, in our view, of attacking Scott's credibility and attacking his mother's credibility, who was a key part of his life and who had her own issues. But counsel also was up against an extremely strong case presented by the state in a case of this nature. Therefore, I ask you to affirm the thorough and reasonable decision of the magistrate as upheld by Judge Crabb. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Just 2 minutes in rebuttal, Mr. Geis.
Well, first of all, I did raise the post-conviction ruling on based on the state evidentiary grounds as a confrontation clause violation in the state courts. I didn't bring the state court briefs with me today, but I did, and how it dovetailed into the Sixth Amendment.
Those are in the record before us?
Yes, those are in the record before us. And it was ignored by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, and, of course, the Wisconsin Supreme Court didn't grant leave. So it was raised both ways. But it's the tail that wags the inefficient assistance of counsel argument. And the other point I want to make on 2 points. One on the rebuttal that the denial to Bryce Mitchell wasn't remote. It was in 1998, and this conduct supposedly began in 1998. So this isn't like something that didn't have anything to do with the accusation. But finally, whether touching the genitals was a sexual assault or it wasn't a sexual assault, or whether the father could have been prosecuted for the sexual assault, those are all questions that are really red herrings in this case. What's important was that Scott thought it was a sexual assault. He knew what a false accusation of sexual assault could do. He admitted it was a lie. He admitted it to his father, and he apologized. Why would he apologize if he didn't take it as having consequences? He told his mother that he did it to get his father's attention. He had a motive for this, whether it was sexual assault or it wasn't. He got the authorities on the trail, and he told his guardian and did it because he was angry and he felt abandoned by his father. So the difference is not, is this technically a sexual assault when a father in the shower touches his son's genitals? It was clearly designed to hurt.
Thank you, Mr. Geis. The case will be taken under advisement. The last case.